Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show where we cut through the noise and get to the core of what you need to know. Today, we're plunging into the fascinating, sometimes quite contentious, world of education research. It's a field that's constantly searching for that elusive holy grail, you know, the definitive answer to what works best to genuinely improve student learning for every student. And when it comes to that quest, one name has really risen to prominence, often hailed by many as having found that holy grail, John Hattie. His monumental work, Visible Learning, truly sounds like an incredibly massive undertaking. I mean, synthesizing over 800 meta-analyses.
Yes, huge.
Encompassing more than 50,000 studies and literally millions of individuals. The sheer scope is, well, it's impressive. So our mission in this deep dive is to unpack the powerful appeal of Hattie's work, but also importantly to delve into the very significant criticisms leveled against it. Mm-hmm. Criticisms from statisticians and other researchers who don't just question his methodology, they actually label it pseudoscience.
Strong words.
Definitely. And crucially, we're going to connect these debates to the broader issue of research replication in education and what it all means for how you, our listener, can interpret educational claims you come across. So let's begin with the allure. What makes Hattie's Visible Learning so uniquely appealing to educators, to policymakers?
Well, I think a big part of it is his uncanny ability to distill these vast amounts of research into these accessible, rank-ordered lists of influences on student achievement. It seems so clear.
Yeah, he even uses the system of dials and zones, including this almost, I don't know, magical hinge point of 0.40 effect size.
That's the one.
And Hattie suggests that educators should prioritize anything above that threshold, calling it the zone of desired effects. It feels incredibly straightforward, almost like a ready-made instruction manual.
Yeah, and I think a key aspect that initially captivates so many people is just the sheer scale and the apparent rigor.
Mm-hmm.
Hattie's method is essentially a meta-analysis. So he's averaging the effect sizes, not from individual studies, but from many other meta-analyses.
Okay, layers upon layers.
Exactly. And this layering, combined with the immense number of studies and individuals included, it just makes it seem like a truly scientific, almost undeniable endeavor. It presents itself as this ultimate comprehensive barometer for educational impact.
So, okay, despite this seemingly robust foundation, why do critics, like the statisticians Pierre Jerome Bergeron and Lysanne Rivard, why do they describe Visible Learning not as this mighty castle, but as a fragile house of cards? That's quite a statement.
It really is. And this is a critical point. What exactly are these methodological errors that lead to such strong criticism? Well, one of the most glaring issues, according to them, lies in what they describe as flagrant calculation errors, specifically in Hattie's Common Language Effects, or CLE.
Okay, what was that meant to do?
So this was Hattie's attempt to make complex statistical effect sizes like Cohen's D more intuitive for educators, kind of translating them into easily understandable probability.
It sounds helpful.
It sounds helpful. But the problem was these calculations resulted in literally impossible outcomes. Things like negative probabilities or probabilities exceeding 100%.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's not good.
Not good at all. And this kind of oversight demonstrates, as these statisticians put it, a total lack of scientific rigor. It really brings to mind that R.A. Fisher adage.
Which one's that?
To consult the statistician after an experiment is finished is often merely to ask him to conduct a post-mortem examination. He can perhaps say what the experiment died of.
Ouch. So consultation should happen before and during, not just after.
Exactly. At every step, ideally. And beyond those miscalculations, a really core critique is that Hattie averages things that, frankly, do not make any sense to average together.
Ah, the apples and oranges problem?
Precisely. Think of that memorable analogy they use. If my head is in the oven and my feet are in the freezer, on average, I'm comfortably warm.
Right, right. Averages can hide extremes.
They really can. And Hattie does this, critics argue, by, say, aggregating every gender difference under the same effect, even though we know real-world data shows vastly different outcomes depending on the context.
Mm-hmm.
Or similarly, combining disparate health problems under a single disease effect, you know, lumping together everything from cancer to digestive problems, it washes out the meaning.
Okay, so the categories are too broad.
Way too broad sometimes.
Yeah.
And another related point is how the selection of a baseline comparison defines whether an effect size is positive or negative.
Mm.
Hattie's interpretations here can seem quite arbitrary.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Take the effect of class size or socioeconomic status. depending on what you compare it to, what you consider the baseline, the effect can appear positive or negative.
Mm.
And that leads to very different interpretations of its impact, right? Then there's another significant problem, the conflation of correlation and causality.
Ah, the classic. Correlation does not equal causation.
Exactly. Hattie often uses formulas to convert correlation, just measures of relationship, into Cohen's D, which is usually interpreted as the strength of an effect or a difference between groups.
But that conversion can be misleading.
It can be quite hazardous, yes, because it might imply a direct impact, a causal link, where there really isn't one, or at least not proven by that data.
Okay.
For instance, the high effect you reports for creativity on academic success. Turns out that's actually based on a correlation between IQ test results and creativity test results. It's not a direct measure of creativity causing academic success.
I see. So it's just two things that tend to go together, maybe because of a third factor like IQ.
Precisely.
Uh-huh.
And the same applies to self-reported grades, the high effect size there. It's actually just showing a strong correlation between what students say their grades are and what their grades actually are. It's not evidence that the act of self-reporting improves grades.
Got it. That's a subtle but really important distinction.
And then, of course, there's that much debated hinge point of 0.40.
Right, the magic number for the zone of desired effects.
Yeah. Robert Slavin, another really respected researcher, strongly critiques Hattie's reliance on this specific number. He argues it misses the essential meaning of effect sizes.
How so?
Slavin contends that even seemingly small effect sizes, maybe plus 0.15 or plus 0.25, can actually be very important.
Why is that?
Because these smaller effect sizes typically come from studies comparing a specific treatment group to a carefully matched control group. They measure how much more students gain from a particular intervention compared to similar students who didn't get it. It's not just comparing against the general effect of any teacher over time, which is sort of what Hattie's 0.40 baseline represents.
Ah, okay. So context matters hugely in what the effect size is actually comparing. 0.15 might be a big deal if it's a well-controlled experiment.
Exactly. Slavin argues that Hattie's hinge point might lead educators to dismiss potentially valuable, cost-effective interventions just because they fall below that arbitrary 0.4's line.
Wow. Okay, these detailed critiques of Hattie's statistical rigor are certainly eye-opening, but what makes this even more compelling and maybe more unsettling is how these specific methodological concerns aren't isolated incidents. They seem to resonate with a much larger systemic challenge within education research itself, which is the alarming rarity of replication studies.
Yeah, now turning to the data on that, it really stands out how stark the situation is.
Hmm?
We're talking less than 0.25%, 0.13%, I think,
tiny,
of education articles published in top journals are actual replications. So out of over 160,000 articles examined in one analysis, only a couple hundred were retests of previous findings.
Wow. How does that compare to other fields?
We'll compare that to psychology, for example, where it's still low, but it's over 1%, about 1.07%. So significantly higher than in education.
Okay.
And even within those few education replications, nearly half are performed by the original research team.
Which might introduce some bias, potentially.
Potentially, yeah. And maybe more telling. When replications are performed by completely new, independent authors, they only succeed, meaning they get similar results about 54% of the time. Compare that to an almost 89% success rate when they're done by the same authors, often in the same journal.
That difference is huge, 54% versus nearly 89%. So what's the fundamental takeaway here for us as listeners, as educators, when we encounter new research? Is it that the very structure of academic publishing might be, well, compromising the reliability of the knowledge we rely on?
That's a really crucial insight, I think. The system, unfortunately, often seems to prioritize novelty over verification. It kind of comes down to this. Education journals, it's argued, routinely prize studies that yield novel and exciting results over studies that corroborate or maybe disconfirm previous findings.
The new and shiny gets published.
Pretty much. And as a result, conducting replications is largely viewed as lacking prestige, originality, or excitement. Researchers worry, probably rightly, about negative impacts on their careers, publishing, promotions, getting grants.
So it's an incentive problem.
It really seems to be. It creates this environment where originality can trump the painstaking, maybe less glamorous work of retesting. And that leads to a kind of systemic vulnerability in the evidence base we use. It's maybe less about individual researchers and more about the incentives baked into the field itself.
And this lack of replication It has this surprising, almost unsettling downside you mentioned. Psychology has weathered numerous fraud allegations in recent years, which sounds bad, but education research has had, quote, not a single fraud accusation in years. Is that actually good?
Well, Jonathan Plucker, one of the researchers who looked into this replication rate, makes a really provocative point. He argues education's supposedly spotless record is no accident. Meaning, he suggests it's potentially a result of scholars who aren't checking each other's work.
Oof. So no accusations because no one's looking closely enough.
That's the Unconstable implication. He warns that without replication, we'll never know which research sits on a foundation of stone and which sits on a foundation of sand. It connects directly to Carl Sagan's idea that science requires ruthless skeptical scrutiny of all ideas, old and new.
Right. Science is supposed to be self-correcting.
Exactly. And if you're not attempting to replicate, that self-correction mechanism is weakened. The discipline's standing, its credibility, is really at stake without it.
Okay, so even if we park the statistical debates and the replication crisis for a moment, there's still another crucial layer to Hattie's work, isn't there? It's about translation. How do we actually translate these findings, even the ones we trust, into actual effective practices in real schools?
Mm-hmm.
Howie Knopf, who's an expert in school improvement, argues that Hattie's work often tells us what to consider, but not how to implement it.
Yeah, and we connect this back to the bigger picture. The challenge is that these huge meta-analyses, by their very nature, often lack the granular detail you need for practical implementation on the ground.
Huh.
So, for example, you might see a high effect size for something like cognitive task analysis. That sounds promising. But the meta-analysis itself probably won't specify the exact step-by-step implementation process that was used in the successful underlying studies that contributed to that average effect size.
So, educators are left with a concept, but not a concrete plan.
Pretty much. They get a promising concept, but without a clear roadmap for how to actually do it effectively in their classroom or school.
Which raises a really important practical question. How can you, as an educator, or maybe just a curious learner, decide if Hattie's seemingly good research is actually the right research for your specific students, your school, your community context?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Howie Knopf highlights a set of guidelines from another researcher, Matthew Kraft, for interpreting effect sizes that are really crucial here.
Okay, let's hear them.
First, always remember that effect sizes from correlational studies are not causal. We touched on this, but it bears repeating. A program might contribute to achievement, but it doesn't necessarily directly cause it in a simple weird. A leads to B way.
Right. Like the phonics example, it enables better reading, which boosts GPA, but it's not the direct cause of the GPA boost itself.
Exactly. Second, the magnitude, the size of the effect size, depends heavily on what outcomes are being measured and when they're measured. Are we looking at short-term effects right after an intervention, or long-term effects a year later, immediate test scores, or deeper conceptual understanding? It matters.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Third, effect sizes are definitely impacted by subjective decisions made during the study design and analysis. Things like what kind of control group was used, or if the study targeted a very specific student sample, those choices affect the numbers.
Okay.
Fourth, and this is huge for schools, you must consider the cost of implementing a program. A high effect size might be totally irrelevant if the cost in terms of money, time, or training is prohibitive.
Absolutely. Practicality.
And finally, related to that, the ease or difficulty in scaling up a program matters immensely. Knopf uses the example of micro-teaching. It might show a really high effect size in small controlled studies.
Right.
But actually scaling that up effectively statewide across hundreds of schools and thousands of teachers, that's a completely different and much harder challenge.
So Knopf suggests a specific process for schools and districts to use.
Yes, he proposes what he calls a multiple gating process to navigate this complexity. It involves several key steps.
Like what?
Well, first, evaluating the methodological and statistical quality of the meta-analyses Hattie includes for a particular influence. Basically, doing your due diligence on the underlying research.
Okay, checking the foundations.
Then, crucially, evaluating the demographics of the students in those original studies. Do they actually match the students in your school or district? Because what works for one group might not work for another.
Very important point.
And you also need to dig deeper to identify the specific implementation methods used in the original studies that contributed most to the positive effects. Not just the general concept, but the actual how-to.
So really getting into the weeds of the original research.
Exactly. And Knopf notes this process is essential because, interestingly, Hattie himself has learned a great deal from taking his work on the road and listening to other researchers, professors, leaders, and teachers. It implies that this real-world context and feedback loop matters immensely, even to the original author. Given all of this complexity, the stats issues, the replication void, the implementation gap, it becomes abundantly clear why statisticians like Bergeron and Rivard insist so strongly that one must consult with a statistician before data collection and during data collection and after, but mostly at each step of the study.
Yeah, it's not just a final check. It's an ongoing conversation.
The nuances of data analysis, especially meta-analysis, are just too great, too full of potential pitfalls to really go it alone effectively.
So, given all of this, what does it truly mean for schools or districts seeking external guidance, especially now that there's this growing cottage industry of Hattie consultants out there? Mm-hmm. Knopf emphasizes the need to ask some very specific, very pointed questions of these consultants, well beyond just checking their affiliations or whether they claim to be trained by Hattie.
Yeah, that's right. He lays out some really critical questions, things like, what specific training do they actually have in evaluating psychoeducational research as it applies to real schools and real students, not just theoretical knowledge?
Okay, practical expertise.
What's their documented track record of success in different kinds of school settings? And how does that past experience actually predict potential success in your specific school or district context?
Right, evidence of their own effectiveness.
Exactly. And what objective research-based processes do they use to determine which specific approaches your district actually needs? How will they determine the concrete implementation steps? Is it tailored or one size fits all?
Good question.
And crucially, how do they evaluate their own services? How do they measure the short-term and long-term impact mm-hmm. of the recommendations they make? Are they accountable?
Mm-hmm. Holding consultants accountable too.
Absolutely. This kind of rigorous questioning helps ensure you avoid being sort of blinded by a big name affiliation and instead focus on genuine research to practice experience and demonstrable results.
And, you know, just to provide some important balance here, it's worth noting Peter DeWitt's perspective. He points out that Hattie himself is apparently quite responsive to critique and mm-hmm. that ultimately perhaps the biggest value of his work isn't necessarily the precise rankings, but that it gets educators talking and reflecting on their own practices, using evidence, and really focusing on their actual impact on students.
That's a fair point. It definitely sparked a conversation, regardless of the methodological debates. Encouraging reflection on practice is always valuable.
So we've really journeyed quite a distance here, from the widespread, almost magnetic appeal of John Hattie's visible learning to the deep methodological concerns raised by statisticians, then connecting that to the broader systemic issues of replication or lack thereof in education research, and finally landing on the very practical on-the-ground challenges of translating broad findings into effective implementation in specific contexts.
It's a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
And I think the key takeaway is that navigating this complex landscape really requires critical thinking from everyone involved. It demands a willingness to ask tough questions, both of the research itself and of those promoting it.
Right.
And a deep understanding that evidence matters, yes, but the quality of that evidence, its context, and its direct applicability to your specific situation are absolutely paramount.
So maybe the final thought for you, our listener, is this. When you next encounter new educational research, or maybe just a promising sounding intervention in any field, really, remember that behind every number, behind every bold claim lies a whole story, a story of methodology, of human decision making, of potential biases, and often an urgent need for more rigorous, replicated evidence before we place too much faith in it. How might you apply the insights from this deep dive to become a more discerning, more critical consumer of knowledge, whatever the field may be?